From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. As the number of confirmed deaths from COVID-19 eclipses 100,000 worldwide, and the number of cases in the U.S. nears 500,000, there is particular focus on dense cities, obviously New York, but also Chicago, home to the Cook County Jail, which has seen one of the worst outbreaks. We're joined now by Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot. Thank you for joining us.
That's my pleasure.
Well, when do you expect the peak of hospitalizations in Chicago, and are you ready for it?
Well, I think it's hard to know right now what the peak will be. There's some question as to whether or not there will be a peak at this point. I think we're making significant progress. We started out in our tracking, seeing cases double every 1 to 2 days, and now we're in the cycle of every 9 to 10 days. So we're starting to see a flattening. So we're constantly looking at our data, but I think we're still some time away before we start to see a downward trend in the number of cases.
You have been releasing demographic data for the people diagnosed with COVID-19, and that data shows that Black Chicago residents are dying at many times the rate of white residents. We know that is a national issue. It's not just in Chicago. But what are you doing with that information to help Black people in your city?
We did two things immediately. Number one is we've entered an order requiring all testers to provide the demographic information. Number two is we've formed a racial equity rapid response team, and this is going to be a hyper-local effort where we are going deep into communities using trusted stakeholders from public health folks, doctors, but also block clubs, faith community. We have a network of street intervention workers. These are people that normally spend time trying to interrupt violence, but we're activating that network as well to connect people up, have them go through a series of questions regarding symptoms and other issues, and then where necessary, connecting them up with healthcare providers.
There's also a lot of concern right now about the Cook County Jail. Now, we should note that the jail is not under your jurisdiction, but it has become the site of a major outbreak, more than 400 cases there among detainees and staff. A judge said the jail does not have to release inmates, but did order the jail to improve conditions. What do you think needs to be done about the Cook County Jail?
Well, I actually think there's a lot of things that are happening at Cook County Jail that haven't kind of come to the media. They've been taking specific steps to depopulate, making sure that inmates are getting tested on the way in, and if they're testing positive at any point, that they're going into quarantine and isolation. Other things that I think we are looking at is whether we can provide any other alternative spaces. But stepping back for a moment, if you look at what is the population of Cook County Jail, overwhelmingly, they are African-American males. The exact same population outside of the jail setting that we're seeing get the infected at disproportionate rates and also, unfortunately, dying at 7 times the rate of any other demographic in our city. So given the realities on the ground, these are the exact kind of circumstances that this disease is ruthlessly attacking.
Mayor Lightfoot, we've heard President Trump go after the governor of Illinois, J.B. Pritzker. He said the governor is always complaining and has not performed well. First of all, do you agree with that? And secondly, do you think President Trump is playing favorites with states like Florida, where he's got a political ally as the governor, at the expense of states like Illinois?
Well, I mean, I think that President Trump has shown himself to be who he is from the moment he walked down the escalators to announce his candidacy for presidency, and it's only been more and more manifest over the last 3.5 years, and particularly acute during this crisis when we need real leadership. We need someone who is paying attention to the science and the data and letting that drive the policy. Our governor is exactly the opposite of President Trump. What we know is that the federal response has been halting. And I knew that back in January when they diverted all the flights to 7 airports across the country, Chicago O'Hare being one of them. What that told me is we needed to get this for ourselves. And that's precisely what we've done. And in my dealings with the administration, I'm always going to call balls and strikes. Were they doing well? For example, the Army Corps of Engineers has been unbelievably spectacular in support of setting up an alternative care facility here. They're great. And I'm going to say that loud to anybody who will listen. But where they've failed, I'm going to say that as well. And I'm going to continue to advocate for residents in my city because we do need additional federal help. We need more testing. We need more PPEs. And we need more relief. I'm appreciative of the stimulus bills, but that's only reimbursing us for the additional expenses that we've incurred. This disease has devastated our economy in certain sectors, and we need to have additional funds to help with our revenues and our budget.
Do you see Chicago businesses reopening next month? The White House is already starting to talk about reopening some parts of the economy in May.
We're not reopening any businesses until we have confidence that we have truly bent the curve and that there's sufficient testing that we can give residents confidence that they can go out in public and be in congregate settings. Until those conditions are prevalent, we can't be talking about anything related to reopening the parts of the economy that have been closed down.
Mayor, I want to ask you one more thing. You've become very popular online with these memes of you telling people not to go out. I saw one that said, your jump shot is always going to be weak. Stay out of the parks. You've been going around the city personally confronting people who do not follow social distancing guidelines. You even broke up an underage drinking party. What makes you do all of that?
It's because I care and I love my city. There's lots of different ways in which we can and should be educating people about the dangers. And I need to be out and present, and I am, and I'll continue to be that person because that's who I am. I love the city. I love the people. And I want to make sure that we get through this and really start to lay the foundation for the kind of recovery that we need to say to ourselves and to the world that Chicago's back.
That is Mayor Lori Lightfoot of Chicago. Mayor, as an Illinoisan myself, I wish you the best of luck to the great city of Chicago through this crisis.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
We move now to Pennsylvania, where this week, Dr. Deborah Birks, the White House coronavirus response coordinator, said she's concerned about what's happening in Philadelphia. The cases of COVID-19 are rising, and the city is soon expected to hit a peak. And like many parts of the country, Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf announced that schools in the state will now remain closed for the rest of the school year. Pennsylvania Secretary of Health, Dr. Rachel Levine, joins us now. And Dr. Levine, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for allowing me to join you.
So first off, tell us what's happening there right now. How are hospitals doing? I know that you said earlier that the state does have enough ventilators. What about protective equipment for doctors?
So we are certainly working with all of our community partners and hospitals and health systems to prepare for the expected surge of patients over the next number of weeks. We do feel that we are getting prepared. We have adequate numbers of ventilators in Pennsylvania, and we actually have more on order. And we have a significant amount of personal protective equipment, which we are then pushing out to hospitals and health systems.
I mentioned how Dr. Deborah Birks announced that she was concerned about what's happening in Philadelphia, the cases rising there. What can you tell us about what's happening there?
Well, we are seeing increases of number of new cases of COVID-19 in Philadelphia. And we talk daily with Dr. Farley, who's the Commissioner of Health for Philadelphia. And we all have regular conversations about making sure that the hospitals and health systems are prepared for this potential surge.
Yeah, what are some of the specific challenges that Philadelphia may be facing that health officials are concerned about?
Well, Philadelphia, of course, is our largest city in Pennsylvania and has much more increased population density. That's a significant risk factor for the spread of COVID-19. But we have worked with Dr. Farley and Philadelphia to buttress their healthcare system. We continue to push out personal protective equipment such as N95 masks every day. In addition, they are setting up a federal medical site or an FMS in an area of Philadelphia to be able to deal with patients with COVID-19.
I want to talk with you about peaking. We have heard from a lot of different places, including the state of Pennsylvania, about flattening the curve. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin is talking about reopening the economy in May. What do you think about that for your state?
Well, so we have been able to flatten the curve with the significant prevention and mitigation efforts of Governor Wolf. But as Dr. Fauci has said, the virus determines the timetable. We don't determine the timetable. And every indication is that May would be too soon for a wide opening of the economy.
Yes. I want to also ask you about rural areas. Aside from Philadelphia, has it been hard to convince people in rural areas where there aren't that many cases that they need to stay home?
Really, throughout Pennsylvania, we are seeing that people are staying at home, and that's why I think we've flattened the curve. But rural areas are still significantly at risk, and in addition to the southeast, like Philadelphia, we have seen significant increases in the northeast, in Lehigh County and Luzerne County and Monroe County. So really, all areas of Pennsylvania are at risk from COVID-19.
That's Pennsylvania Secretary of Health, Dr. Rachel Levine. Dr. Levine, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/here now. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply. Offer valid through March 31st, 2020.
Well, if you've ventured out to a store in the last few weeks, you know toilet paper is in short supply. We've been hearing about a lot of folks out there who brought up huge amounts to stockpile early on, both from stores and online. And while that might have had some impact on this shortage we're seeing, our next guest believes the shortage actually has to do with the supply chain. Jim Luke is professor of economics at Lansing Community College in Michigan, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Hi.
Let's break this down a little bit more. So there are two types of toilet paper. We all know it if you go to work or to school. It's a lot different than the toilet paper we buy in our homes. So this industry is really divided into two markets, retail and commercial. How do they differ in production? And how has this sharp increase in demand that you talk about, kind of taking that wave in mid-March, impacted the level of production?
Well, toilet paper is an incredibly efficient supply chain. And so just that slight increase in demand started to make shelves look empty. It was actually kind of an illusion. So there was some initial hoarding. If it were just that, we would get past it within a few weeks. But when we went to the majority of the workforce now working from home or just not working at all, that shifted things into we're not using any more toilet paper than we used to. It's that we're using toilet paper that we got through a different channel. So the retail channel and what's called the away-from-home channel, business, schools, hospitals, institutions, two very different channels. They're very different products, actually. They don't come from the same machines. They don't necessarily come from the same companies. One company, Procter & Gamble, for example, is huge in the retail market and is not as big a player. I'm not sure even they play at all in the away-from-home market. So we may have a shortage on grocery shelves, but we've actually got excess elsewhere. The problem is that excess can't be redirected very easily, and I'm not sure it would even work.
Hmm. We have been hearing, though, that there are stories of people waiting in line for commercial toilet paper. Some manufacturers, some smaller ones, are trying to sell it direct. Should people start considering? Is that even possible on a large scale? I mean, these are small manufacturers we're talking about.
If they can switch around and be agile enough to actually do that, sure, by all means, that's a good thing. And if you've got access to it as a customer, go ahead and do that. some of the product is kind of awkward because some of those industrial rolls are a foot in diameter. Where are you going to put that in the bathroom?
Right, right. It takes up space. Absolutely. I want to go back to the point you made about the retail market and its efficient supply chain, which is being thrown off because of the demand. What can correct that? I mean, there are folks that are going to the store every day searching for toilet paper, my family being one of them. You can't buy it online either. It's nowhere to be found.
There's unfortunately not a lot that can be done. You would think, oh, well, you could just switch a mill or a machine over. And that's actually not really very cost effective. Because the catch with toilet paper of either type is there's just no money in it. It's extremely low margin. So the only way you can profitably make it is you've got to run that machine 24/7. And then as soon as it comes off the mill in these giant, huge rolls, it goes to the next stage where it gets what's called converted. And that's where it's made into small rolls that you would actually use in your bathroom. And then it goes to distribution centers on trucks. For the most part, those trucks are just unloaded, and those cartons or pallets are then split up among other trucks that then go directly to stores. The reality is, most of the toilet paper you use has actually pretty much been produced just in time.
So is there incentive for these, and is it even possible or feasible for these companies to ramp up their production to meet this demand that we have right now?
It's possible. There are no big home runs that can be hit where you can just go, okay, we'll flip a switch here and we'll get a big giant increase in production on this. The industry is actually very good at tweaking and getting a little more out of it. It just takes time. So as time goes by, we're going to be better off. You know, the shortage will slow down.
And then our behaviors will change as we get out of crisis mode, is what I'm hearing you say.
Right. Now, what it's going to take to get all the way back to, you know, the old days is pretty much we would have to see most of the country actually get back to spending a work day elsewhere, not at home.
Jim Luke is a professor of economics at Lansing Community College in Michigan. Jim, thank you for this lesson on the supply chain of toilet paper. It was really informative. Appreciate it.
Thank you for the time.
Well, let's go now to our regular social media roundup with Femi OK, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English. Hi, Femi.
Hello there, Jeremy.
So during this pandemic, many businesses are feeling the impacts of sudden closures, and researchers at the University of Bristol in the UK have been looking into how social media might be used as an economic forecaster. Tell us more about that.
It's such a simple idea. They worked on the basis of when a business is shut down, they are not posting much on Facebook, they're not engaging with their audience. When a business is up and running, of course the posts are out there, they're connecting, they're talking about their business. So a very simple metric. And they used a hurricane and a couple of natural disasters like earthquakes to actually test this theory. And it actually worked. They saw that when a business were opening and beginning to open, there was more activity on social media. That gave the idea for the authorities for them to be able to give them more resources to support the businesses, etc. So they know it worked in these individual situations of natural disasters, but could it work for recovery after the coronavirus pandemic? That is what they would love to try. And very simply, just looking at social media and the posts and how much businesses are engaging with their audiences, that may help decide when the economic recovery is actually happening. I never thought we'd look at social media for that, but it seems like a very basic and sensible idea.
Yeah, and it's going to be very interesting just in general to see how things start to open, when they start to open, and who is ready to go out and start buying or going to restaurants and things like that again after all of this subsides. Meanwhile, the CDC is recommending people wear face coverings to slow the spread of COVID-19. The First Lady, Melania Trump, went on Twitter yesterday to encourage people to wear them in public settings. Listen.
Remember, this does not replace the importance of social distancing. It is another recommended guideline to keep us all safe.
the first lady telling people to wear masks there, in contrast, of course, to President Trump, who has said people should wear masks, but he doesn't want to wear a mask himself.
And the first lady and people online were commenting, she looks fabulous. She's holding a face mask, but she's not wearing one. And commenters were saying, well, she's got a sultry glare. She's looking at the camera, but this isn't helping, just holding one. But there are lots of tutorials that even the first lady can actually look at if she wants to try one herself, where you can actually find out how to do it. There are no sewing tutorials. There are sewing tutorials. There are ones that use old socks, T-shirts, rubber bands, whatever works for you, covering up your face. One place I do recommend you go to, and that is the CDC website. They will tell you how to make your own homemade face mask and then how to take it off and how to launder it. So you are doing yourself some good by covering up your nose and your mouth.
You know, one thing I saw on social media that got me excited, Femi, is that Saturday Night Live is going to be back this weekend. Now, they're going to be doing it in a little bit of a different way. The cast shared a grid view of their faces on a video chat to promote the return. How do we think it's going to work?
All right. So this is it. Hashtag SNL at home. Follow that for all the latest. It's going to be a one-off at the moment. They will be new material. It will be promoted remotely, so there'll be social distancing between all the cast members. There will be a weekend update. SNL cast members will all be there. There will be no host, and there are rumours of special guest appearances. In fact, fans out there are suggesting, oh, we have to have a Tiger King sketch. Production may be tricky, but how could we not? Alec Baldwin's Donald Trump may make a remote appearance, ? Jesse Hawking posts on Twitter, I really hope Bernie Sanders goes on the show Saturday to do a skit with Larry David, where he teases the people who want him to endorse Biden. So many ideas out there, so much excitement about what this remote SNL might be looking like. And then, of course, we can't talk about SNL without talking about the haters who love to hate it. Ken Bone, we're going through enough as it is. Please don't do this to us.
You know, speaking of Larry David, Femi, I don't know if you saw this, but in the New York Times last weekend, Maureen Dowd interviewed Larry David, and he went off on all kinds of tangents, including the following. He said, I never could have lived in the Old West. I would have been completely paranoid about someone stealing my horse. No locks. You tie them to a post. How could you go into a saloon and enjoy yourself knowing your horse could get taken at any moment? I would be so distracted, constantly checking to see if he was still there.
Oh, I love him. He's so funny. And that's like, you would, wouldn't you? I mean, we all lock our cars. What would you do with a horse?
I think we should leave it there on a nice note. Femi Okay, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English. Stay safe, Femi, and thank you.
You're welcome, Jeremy. Take care.
Snowbirds, those retirees who have a home up north but spend the winter in Florida or somewhere else that's warm, well, they're being told by officials in their home states to stay away. Danielle Kading from Wisconsin Public Radio reports.
Mike Herrick and his wife Jane live in Herbster, Wisconsin on Lake Superior, but they've been heading to Tucson, Arizona over the winter for the last 11 years. They were hoping to come home soon, but local and state leaders have asked some homeowners not to return. Herrick worries his landlord might make staying there unaffordable.
It's expensive to live here on a rental basis. But if things took a turn for the worse where you are advised not to travel at all, I don't think we have an option then. We're going to have to stay here.
That's not yet the case. Some Wisconsin residents can return home, but seasonal homeowners are being urged to stay away. State officials say those who do come back should isolate themselves for 2 weeks. That's what Steve and Mary McHugh have been doing after driving 26 hours north from their rental home in Venice, Florida, to their house on Wisconsin's Madeleine Island.
And we're basically locked down outside of doing a daily walk to the local park and back.
McHugh says they're taking it in stride. He's even sharing sounds and scenes of the island on social media for others stuck indoors. Here's geese hanging out by the water. More than 1,000 miles to the east is the island of North Haven, Maine. Town officials recently barred travel for seasonal and second homeowners. Those residents make up 85% of the town's tax base.
Tough position. It would be like, well, we really don't want you coming, but we really want you to come.
That's John Demons, chair of the North Haven Select Board. It changed that order to a request after complaints from outside residents. But the island only has one small clinic, and an influx of thousands of seasonal residents worries him.
Our facility is not that large. We would be in hard shape to be able to take care of that many people.
The town wanted Maine's Governor Janet Mills to limit non-essential travel to the island. Governor Mills says if people think they can escape the virus by fleeing north, think again.
They are wrong. They cannot escape it because it is here. It is everywhere.
Governors in Wisconsin and Minnesota have banned unnecessary travel and ordered people to stay home. But that apparently hasn't ebbed the flow of people heading up north. Dennis Rizdahl is CEO of Bluefin Bay Family Resorts on Minnesota's North Shore, where his company manages about 100 homes.
A lot of people feel that it's safer here because it's so uncrowded.
Marlis Graff and her husband Dick usually head back to their seasonal home in northern Wisconsin from Titusville, Florida, by early May. Now their plans are on hold. She says it's rough they won't be able to see their family soon, but they're making the best of it. Still, she hopes not to spend the summer in Florida.
We really don't want to be here, but we're not worrying about that yet. Really, this whole thing is day to day. Everything changes day to day.
For NPR News, I'm Danielle Kading.
It's here and now. Being a single parent is a challenge under any circumstance, but it's especially tough now with so many of us isolated, scared, and struggling financially because of this pandemic. Aarti Shahani, an NPR contributor and author, has been following several single mothers from the San Francisco Bay Area, and she's been recording them every night in a nightly journal, talking to them about what life is like for them right now. Welcome to Here and Now, Aarti.
Thanks for having me.
Aarti, you're sharing with us today the stories of two mothers, Rochelle Rasmussen and Tracy Dooley. What can you tell us about them?
Sure. So Rochelle Rasmussen, she's 39 years old. She lives in Santa Clara with her two little boys. Simon is 2 years old. Ziggy is 3 months old.
Wow.
And the reason, the reason she's raising them alone right now is last July, she had a domestic violence incident with her husband. And so since then, he has not been living with them. He's pretty much been out of their lives.
And then there's Tracy.
Yeah. Tracy is 38 years old. Her daughter is in kindergarten. They live in Berkeley, California. And, you know, Tracy, she actually went to medical school at Stanford, but then she decided to not become a doctor. She does medical investing, though, healthcare investing. And she lost her husband, actually, in a really terrible car accident 5 years ago. So she's a widow. And for her, as well as for Rochelle, for the both of them, in their audio diaries to me, they reflect on what it feels like to be taking on this quarantine alone.
Okay, let's get right to it. You'll hear Rochelle speak first, followed by Tracy.
Today, basically, I had tears that kept rolling down my face, and I had no idea why. And I think it's because I was kind of missing my husband in a way. At the same time, I was just sad for his choice to do what he did. But I think I'm a strong woman.
And then you're up at 2 a.m. in the middle of the night, and your kid is crying about how her father's dead, and there's nothing you can say, and it sucks, and it hurts.
I put my specialized bike on the Facebook marketplace because I wanted to sell it. I bought it new, brand new, for $1,300, and I barely used it. I put it on the marketplace for $600, but they've been trying to tell me to ask me to sell it to them for $300. We'll see.
And so I got a tiara'd head poking into my Zoom call. That was entertaining. The CEO of the company who we were talking to were all very kind about it. They all have kids who are much older, so they remember these days too. But it's just, you know, this is kind of our new normal, right?
Both of them are taking a nap right now. I came to put them to bed and I fell asleep with them. I just woke up. I'm nursing the baby right now on the bed. And then I stopped at my friend's house and then she came out and brought us some hand sanitizer. That was nice of her.
I can't cut myself. I can't, you know, have anything happen. I don't want to fall and hurt myself, you know, because there's going to be nobody to drive me to the emergency room. You know, that's always something that's sort of in the back of my mind, right? That there's no backup. You know, you as a single parent, you're it. And luck stops with you.
We're hearing very powerful commonalities. The buck stops here. It's that way for both of them. But there are differences. What's the takeaway?
You know, I would say it's two things. A deep commonality I see in the both of them is part of what helps them to survive is the urgency around caring for their kids, but also their identities outside of motherhood. Rochelle is like a Zumba queen, and she has been working out in the wee hours when she can just to keep sane. And so it's really apparent to me that their survival strategy has everything to do with being more than just one thing. And the other thing I'd say it's really clear, we don't talk in policy circles, in serious policy circles, about the fact that, oh, the U.S. has the highest rate of children living in single-parent households. So right. I feel like my takeaways are the emotional and I'd say spiritual resilience of the women that are dealing, but also the kind of blind spots as to what does and doesn't make it to a policy-level conversation. And single moms do not make it to that level.
That's Aarti Shahani, whose reporting was made possible by the Fuller Project, a journalism nonprofit that focuses on global issues impacting women. Aarti,
thank you so much for this work and giving us a lens, and thank you to the women who were so vulnerable to you.
Thank you.
Well, in the state of Louisiana, there is now more than 18,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19, and this is amid another ongoing health crisis. Louisiana has the fourth highest rate of new HIV infections in the country, with more than 20,000 people already living with the disease. And since HIV targets a person's immune system, healthcare providers are worried that those living with it are particularly at high risk. For a deeper look, we're joined by Carol Giles. She's the Director of Client Services at the Comprehensive Care Center of Southwest Louisiana. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. This is a pleasure.
Yes. So your center serves over 600 patients, and in some cases, it's where they also receive their primary care. How have the center's services changed since this COVID-19 outbreak?
Our medical providers have been trying very hard to encourage our PrEP patients to stay on their PrEP medication so that they will be protected no matter what their behaviors are. We are doing blood testing for HIV through our lab. If someone comes and wants to get tested, we're not going to turn them away. But it won't be a rapid test. It'll be a test that requires some time to come back.
Your organization also provides transportation and food. Are those services still available? And how are you keeping people safe during all of that?
Yes, we are still providing services. We locked down our agency about a week and a half ago. So patients who receive gas cards or bus tokens are calling their case manager, and then we're taking forms and transportation assistance out to them. Our case managers are wearing masks and gloves. Our food pantry is open on its regular schedule, and we've pledged to do that as long as we have supplies.
Yeah, and that's very important because so much of your population are low income, and they really need this service.
They do. Most of the food pantries in our area have closed because they're staffed by volunteers, many of whom are in high-risk age groups. So we are really critical at this point. Food stamp programs in Louisiana are at an all-time low in terms of benefits. We have single male clients who receive as little as $11 a month in food stamps. So our food pantry is really vital for our clients who need food support.
Yeah. You know, your organization is really committed to outreach and rapid testing. Right now, you all are not able to do that. I can imagine this is distressing because, as we mentioned earlier, this is a state that we are seeing an increase in people being diagnosed with HIV and AIDS. What are your biggest concerns right now?
My biggest concern is that when all of this is over, we're going to see an increase in HIV cases. I'm concerned that we're going to have people who were not able to access protective materials like condoms, who got off of their pre-exposure prophylaxis, their PrEP medication, and that we're going to see increased cases.
That's Carol Giles. She is the Director of Client Services at the Comprehensive Care Center of Southwest Louisiana. Thank you so much for taking the time to share the work that you're doing.
Again, this has been a pleasure. Thank you.
Enough with Tiger King. After weeks of quarantine, it's time for some new TV recommendations. So let's bring in NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
Well, I have to say, TV has been saving this quarantine for so many of us, even though Hollywood has shut down along with everything else. And there are a lot of shows in the pipeline about to come out. What's on your radar?
Yeah, this is a really interesting time because on the one hand, of course, they're not making any new shows, but there seems to be a ton of shows coming out. I mean, especially this week, we saw the end of a much-beloved series, Schitt's Creek, on Pop TV. Mm-hmm. We saw the finale after 11 seasons of Modern Family on ABC. We saw Jimmy Kimmel become the new host of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire on ABC. Mm-hmm. And we've also got a bunch of new shows debuting this week and this weekend. So one of the first shows I wanted to talk about was The Good Fight. Now, this show is a spinoff of The Good Wife, which was on CBS. And in this new season that starts, they're really pushing the boundaries of storytelling. The main character, Diana Lockhart, is having a dream in the first episode back where Hillary Clinton was elected president instead of Donald Trump. And because of that, a bunch of things happen, including different people on the Supreme Court. Let's listen to this clip.
Merrick Garland and Elizabeth Warren are on the Supreme Court.
You're worrying me, Diane.
What happened to Kavanaugh?
Who's that?
She can barely contain her glee. But then she later finds out that the Me Too movement never happened. Hmm. And because of that, Harvey Weinstein is still a respected producer in Hollywood. So this is a show that I felt has always been a good legal drama that never got the attention it deserved because it airs on a streaming service, CBS All Access. And so they seem to be pushing for a more provocative storylines that maybe will get them some more attention. But it also means that the storylines are a little less believable. But for people who love the show, I think there's going to be a lot of interesting storylines there.
BBC America also returned this week with their offbeat thriller, Killing Eve. What do you make of this season?
So this is another show that started really strong in its first season, but seemed to have problems in its second season sustaining this really unique chemistry between the lead character, Eve Pilastri, played by Sandra Oh, who's a sort of workaday, a typical analyst for British intelligence, who somehow has this ability to predict what this master assassin named Villanelle is going to do. They have a bond that's at least romantic in Villanelle's eyes. She is attracted to Sandra Oh's character. And at the end of the last season, we saw Villanelle thought that she had killed Sandra Oh's character, but she hadn't. And so now, as the new season opens, Villanelle is starting her life over with somebody new. But because she's a psychopath, she isn't quite able to make this relationship work. She's giving a speech at her own wedding and has a little trouble because she's a little self-focused and she's a little homicidal. Let's check it out.
When we'd met, I just had a really bad breakup. But when I think about my ex today, I realize I am so much happier now she's dead.
Yeah, and so the people in the party don't quite know what to make out of that. But of course, eventually, these two characters come to realize that they're both still alive. This is a really interesting show. I loved it in its first season, not so much in the second season. In the third season, I really want to see these characters in action again. I'm still not sure the writers of the show have figured out how to keep the storylines going in a way that re-engages that feeling that we got watching the first season when it felt so fresh mm-hmm. and so different and so new.
So, Eric, you know what I've been watching throughout this entire quarantine?
Uh-oh, what?
Insecure from beginning to now. And that makes me so excited awesome. To say that the new season is coming out this weekend, season 4 of Insecure. This is the show that stars Issa Rae as a young black woman trying to make it in LA. It's on HBO. What can you tell us about season 4?
So season 4 opens with Issa declaring that she is done messing around with the woman who's been her best friend through a lot of it, Molly. Their friendship seems like it's always on the verge of kind of falling apart. And we see in the beginning of this, the first episode of this new season, that it actually has. And then it goes back to tell us the story of how it happened.
Well, I have to say, the other thing I love about the show Insecure is it is such a love letter to Los Angeles. It makes L.A. look so great.
Exactly.
And really feels real, feels like real L.A.
Well, I got to tell you, the thing that's also kind of bizarre is to see this storyline play out in a world where there is no coronavirus lockdown.
Yeah.
So she's planning a block party with a bunch of people. And all these folks are hanging out. And it's almost like, you know, it's not only a love letter to L.A., watching it in these times is a love letter to the kind of life that we used to have before we had to worry about a pandemic.
There will be block parties again. I know there will be block parties again at some point.
I am Eric trusting Deggans, you, my friend.
That is NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Eric, thanks as always.
Thank you very much.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.